This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's Thursday. It's the first Thursday of the year, and it's a Tech Thursday with Karamjit Singh from Digital News Asia. Welcome back, Karam. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you. And Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. And let me be the first to wish you a Kung Se Fa Choy.
Yes, it has started already, all the celebrations. Anyways, Karam, we have to start talking about the highlights of 2016, because you wrote your fave five of 2016. Yeah. It's the third time you're doing this as well?
Yeah, third year in a row. And then, of course, every one of the writers and editors in DNA did their also, but I'm more familiar with mine, so I'll talk about mine. Yeah. So I actually kind of cheated, and I said if there were six stories, I would have added the one where MEFCAP signed MOUs with Elixir Capital and Gobi Partners. Both are VCs, right? Gobi Partners is China-based. Elixir Capital is Silicon Valley-based, to hopefully raise a combined $450 million right, in venture funding. Yeah, incredible, right? But I actually didn't put that in. That would have been my sixth article. My top five were those that I enjoyed writing and I felt were significant if you look back over the year. And in no particular order, although I think, honestly, this is the most important one. I interviewed Dato' Hafsa Hashim, SME Corp CEO. This was in May, last May, talking about, you know, Malaysian SMEs and innovation. And it opened up my eyes because I think Hafsa used the word that the productivity among our SMEs is stubbornly low. And one reason is because they don't adopt technology a lot, and they also, even the automation levels are low in them. And there was a 2012 National SME Development Council report that also, so the weaknesses are known, because this 2012 National SME Development Council report says that the SMEs face increasing difficulties in recruiting and retaining skilled workers, right, at both the technical, supervisory, and managerial level. So the talent, you know, for them, it's getting harder for them to get talent in these three areas. And on the other hand, the technology and the automation they're using are at low level. So you've got the double whammy there. And in November, a new study by the OECD said that, also reemphasized that there's little innovation happening among SMEs. And because of this, coupled with low levels of automation, right, in our manufacturing-based SMEs, because most of them are in the services space, what this means is that there's a clear and present danger to Malaysia, our ambitions in becoming a developed nation. If your SMEs are not being innovative and not, you know, creating new stuff or process improvements, maybe not product improvement, process improvements, and that's about 12-13% of our SME base, we're not going to be able to reach that developed nation status, because everybody's got to pull their weight, right? You cannot just say the big companies drag everyone along, no. And that's really worrisome. And even more so, I spoke to Dato' Michael Kang, the president of the SMI Association of Malaysia, and he said, I could quote him, he says that if in 3 years, Malaysian SMEs don't move up the automation value chain, because most of them now are stuck in manufacturing 2.0. If they don't move up to 3.0 in 3 years, 1,000 days from now, he said they will die. No exaggeration on his part, you know, and that really scared me. And I spoke to someone from FMM, said the same thing. He didn't say they'll die, but he said our manufacturing, most of our manufacturing base is still in 2.0. What's going to happen is, because 3.0 just means that you become more efficient in producing your product and high quality product, your customer will start saying that, hey, why am I giving my business to Jeff when he's still using, you know, all automation technology and all? I'm going to move to someone who can give me, you know, manufacturing where the quality is higher and you can have a bit more of, it's a bit more flexible also in terms of what you need from your SME manufacturer. I'm going to take my business somewhere else. So their customers will leave and you're left there, right? So you don't have business, what happens is you start scaling down your operations, you start hiring less people, less salaries are being paid, less EPF, less income tax deducted, right? It's a negative, very ugly chain. So that kind of made me realize that, hey, you know, based on the story in May and versus my conversation with some people last month and November around manufacturing, I said this is a really important story, and we need to do something dramatic, because the solution, not the solutions, but the problems are well known. We need to really drag some of these SMEs up the value chain, because otherwise, you know, it's a real danger there. And I'm scared.
What's your other picks for your fave five? Like, we can't go all five.
Exactly.
So that's one of the big picks. Any digital startups kind of thing?
No. I had Brick and Click. So I had three of the articles that I picked were a Brick and Click, you know, flavor. And one of them was Singheng. You know, I think a lot of people know the Singheng outlets. And it's a fantastic entrepreneur story when he started with half a shop lot, you know, and then moved up to where he's got a few hundred, 200, over 200 stores. And in 2014, he crossed ₱1 billion in revenue. Amazing story. But what's amazing is that very early on, he knew that technology. So for him, he wasn't afraid that he didn't understand technology. He just like Tony Fernandez, technology is a tool to be able to help me run my business better, right? More efficient. And which businessman, entrepreneur doesn't want that, correct? So because of that, he got interested in applying technology to his business. He started off with using just point of sale system. God, that gave him visibility of sales. But he realized that it took him a month before the team could give him the numbers. How did we do last month over sales? Then he started using point of sales that shortened the cycle. And then he moved to big data. He realized then that, when you have point of sale, it gives you data, right? Mm. He said, we started with small data, and now we moved on to big data. And he actually has an entire team that helps him, to understand the data points that are coming in. So that now he now gets it, within the day, he can see what kind of, or sometimes even within the hour. Not sometimes. I think he has the ability, but I don't want to reveal how fast it is. But definitely within the day, he knows where are sales going, which outlets have slow sales. And he can inquire with the store managers, right, what's going on. Can you imagine someone way back in 1989, I started with one half an outlet, now moving on to 200 outlets. But outlets is great, that gives you scale. But then he realized, hey, data is important, helps me run my business better, gives me more visibility.
And it's obviously it's brick and mortar.
Brick and mortar. So now,
and now they're applying technology to it.
Yes. And so the brick and click came because Jeff, last year, he introduced his e-commerce store. So you got singheng.com, you can go and check it out. Mm-hmm. And so, but the to be honest, the user interface is horrible, because I did buy a new TV after my old one conked out of me. I really, stretched the lifespan of that one. And I went to his website and it was just a terrible experience. And I said, as much as my heart said, I want to give him my business, give Singheng my business, because I know the entrepreneur, his growth. But I just couldn't, because there wasn't enough information for me. And I happened to be in a mall one day, and I walked by a store. I won't say the brand, like, I'm not going to, right? And they were having 10 units, because end of the year, they say 10 units at ₱1,000 off. I say, wow, okay. So as digital as I write about, as a digital, I want to be, I ended up, because it's, let's say serendipity or just chance, right? Hey, you're $1,000 off this TV. And I looked at it. He turned on a model. They had a display model. Looked at it. Okay, good. Other customers complained, blah, blah, blah. I ended up getting it there. A bit embarrassed to say, lah. But let's finish up with Singheng. What's even more important, because of his big data journey, he has set up a team of about 20 people who understand how to crunch data points for businesses and give them the information that they can act on. He says, guys, since we've learned this, let's now provide this as a service to other SMEs. Because that other SMEs will face the same problems. Let us help them now. So for a lot of SMEs out there, not that I'm driving business to Singheng, but he's gone through the hard work of trying to understand data, and it works for him now. And he said, we'll offer this as a service to others too. So
it's a good
insight. For SMEs, there's a way up.
Yeah, and it's a very good understanding of the inside of how a business like like Singheng,
correct,
started like you mentioned, half shop, brick and mortar,
yes,
and how they use technology for a traditional business, a retail business, right? And it's amazing.
And he's from them, right? So they understand. Hey, he's one of us, right? Although now he's no more an SME, but he was there. And you speak the same lingo. We got three more, but I'm gonna just quickly go to one, which is one of my highlights was also, and this is biased because we had our own brick and mortar conference, brick and click conference. Called What's Next, and it's a fantastic conference. I'm biased opinion, but you can read the articles and you can see why. Getting brick and mortar CEOs to come and talk to you, amazing anecdotes that came out from there. And Vincent Tan, right, who poured cold notion on the fact that fintechs are going to be eating up the banks for breakfast. And he says, no, he said banks are going to end up acquiring the fintechs that show some traction and show real value. But no fintech is going to, beat a bank until a bank closes down or whatever. So this is a lead-in to after when Dr. Sivapalan comes, if he arrives on the show.
Yeah, we're paging for Dr. Sivapalan to come onto the show. Anyways, we will go for a short break, but when we come back, we'll have another sort of prediction, because Patrick Groove of Catcher Digital, he just made his 7 predictions
for
Southeast Asia scene in 2017.
I don't agree with all of them, so let's
we'll talk about that and a whole bunch of other stories. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9.
And this is Tech Thursday with Karamjit Singh from Digital News Asia. And Karam, just before we went for a break, we were talking about, you know, your conversation that will happen with Dr. V. Sivapalan.
Yes.
And we were paging for Dr. V. Sivapalan.
Correct.
And he's here in the studio.
Lo and behold, man, teleportation.
He's the president of the Malaysian Business Angel Network, MBAN, and also the chief evangelist for Proficio Consultants. Did I say it right?
Yes.
All right. So, Dr. V. Sivapalan, thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
There is like a debate that will sort of happen later. Later on in the show, it sort of exploded on Facebook, and now we're bringing it on radio because we need to get this right in that sense,
okay.
Right?
I'm all ready for it.
But before we do that, early on, Karam was talking about his Fave 5 of 2016, and coincidentally, Patrick Grove, he did his 7 predictions for Southeast Asia tech scene in 2017.
Correct.
And we're going to go through this sort of live. And
live, because I haven't read it, what his predictions were. I glanced at them last night, and my team put them up while I was out for appointments earlier.
So his first one that he predicted is Southeast Asia will become the bigger internet market than America.
Beep! Wrong. Did I mimic the right one? We get the wrong answer?
Why so, Karam? Right, why so? Why so?
No, come on, la. First of all, look, Patrick Grove has a vested interest in being bullish about Southeast Asia because he's making his gazillions from the companies he's invested in who are trying to dominate the space that they're in, right, in Southeast Asia. So, of course, he's going to talk it up and he's only going to see the green and greener side of the picture. Right? So when you say that it's going to become a bigger picture, and actually, there was, I think, he shared it on his LinkedIn and somebody was doubtful. Somebody put a comment there. So I think you're too bullish, you know. When you look at the infrastructure needs of the region, you know, they're lacking. They need huge amounts of infrastructure on a yearly basis. How do you justify saying this?
Mm. So, well, he says here the ASEAN region will register over 300 million smartphone users in 2017 compared to America, which only has about 225 million. Yeah. So with that, you there is some point towards it.
That's a very weak point, you know, to stand on and say, you know, we are going to be a bigger internet market than America just based on the fact that they're going to be 300 million smartphones. So
at the moment, we're more of the consumers and the creators when it comes
exactly.
to...
Yeah, exactly. We're more consumers and that's fine because he wants people to consume the content that his companies are pushing out. But that's just a weak argument to say that because they're going to be 300 smartphone users and are they all going to be having data plans and how often are they going to be having data plans? Mm-hmm. Most of them use their data plans for social media, for communications, right? Not for commerce. I don't think you can monetize a large number of...
We have to go through it very...
300 million, yeah.
Very
so
quickly,
that's my point I'm saying.
Because that's just point one.
Yeah, and then the GDP, right? The earning power, you know, per person in the US versus in this region... Forget about it, right? So really, you know, people, you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? You got to take care of food, shelter, and sex, right? Which means just something like, I always try to get in the S sex word in
that's
the year.
Not in
so
Maslow's,
I did it, try,
I
yeah, lucky if Frida's not here. No, but you know, you haven't taken care of the basics. You cannot go on to the aspirational, right? And to the want to have. Mm. So that's my contention.
He's got a few things on startups as well. One, he was saying like funding will be harder to get, so conserve what you
that's
have.
A bit late. This prediction should have come out in 2016, right, Siva? What do you think?
Yes, correct.
I'll talk about Siva now, very slightly.
Second half of last year was already extremely tough.
Brutal.
I think it's going to be just as difficult this year, if not more difficult, to get funding.
And then also you're saying at least 3 companies will raise 9-figure rounds, $100 million US dollars and above.
Mm. So this, he would have better insight into the whispers and the conversations that are going on there. I think if that happens this year in South, I guess it's in, he doesn't really say whether it's in Southeast Asia, but
Southeast
I guess
Asia.
It's
Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Definitely.
Oh yeah, correct. Because his predictions are for the region, yeah.
And then the other one is there will be another exit in excess of 500 million US dollars.
That I don't think so. I don't think you're going to see an exit yet this year. I don't see anyone having built enough value, and you always rely on the Japanese to go a bit crazy and do that, right? So I don't know whether that's going to happen this year. Overall, the yen is getting stronger. I don't know about that. The second one about the third point about three companies maybe raising that much, I give him that. Maybe it will happen.
The year of
but
China?
The exit, no.
The year of China is number 5?
Oh, yeah, the year of China, of course. Yeah. The big three
it's already happened.
Right? So, Siva, what do you think about the... Put Siva on the spot with the exit of 500 million US this year. You know, with the US dollar on steroids, that's just a huge ask. I don't know. ASK, yeah?
I don't know. I think the only area that might happen in is e-commerce, perhaps. you know.
No, margins are there so low.
If Alibaba comes in and you know, buys some company here or something like that.
It could.
Right? No, I say no. Not in e-commerce. Nobody comes close to a kind of valuation where they're going to get $500 million. Come on,
the year of China, that's definitely
looks like,
true.
Looks like I don't think Siva has caught it a hype cloud.
No, I don't think so. I said if it's going to happen, it probably can only happen in the e-commerce.
No, region. I don't see anyone in the region.
In every other area, you don't find
nobody in e-commerce in Southeast Asia has built enough value. You look at Redmart, right? Raised so much money just a year over, 13 months ago, and then they were forced to sell because they couldn't get the next round, right? To the Chinese.
That's why Alibaba probably, it's if there's a day of them coming in.
But not at this amount, no way. And not at this exit of this amount.
Before we go on to the sixth pointer, which is the one where we will have like a sort of a debate, which is around fintech, but we'll move on to the other one, which is every week a different startup will run out of money.
Oh, wow. Nasty, every man. Week. Spicy. Wow. Yeah. I don't know. That could be, you know,
it's a tough year.
Dr. Siva, you know, who can really, because he's been involved in the ecosystem since 1999, he could really publish an encyclopedia, a 12-volume encyclopedia. No, I'm not joking. Look at that. There's no smile on my face. I'm very serious. He could publish an encyclopedia. Okay, you guys are forcing me to smile now.
We can't tell on radio, by the way,
a 12-part encyclopedia called, you know, decrypting the DNA of failure. He could do that because he's seen so many.
He's trying to pitch a new project to you.
I know, it looks like it.
Doesn't mean it's bad, right? Failure is just a stepping stone to success, but, you know, it's just so hard to do. And to say that one startup will fail or will run out of money, which is the same as failure, right? I think that could very well happen also. It's probably already happening.
Yeah, it's easy to happen. Yeah. If you look at the number of startups in Malaysia, he's talking about Southeast Asia.
Yeah, he's talking about Southeast Asia.
Malaysia alone has 3,000 over startups in one way or form or the other. You know, one a week is only 52. I think it'll be a lot more than that.
That's Patrick cheating. I want to make sure I get one right. That's Karam will come after me. January 2017. No, 2018.
Yeah. Now, the other one that he has, there will be a widespread embrace of fintech. Mm-hmm. Now, fintech is that one word where, you know, 2016, everyone was going, it was raving about it. You know, everyone was talking about it. And Dr. V. Sivapalan, you actually wrote a title saying "Goodbye Banks, Hello Fintech."
Yes.
And it was a story about how banks are going to be, you know, facing that Kodak moment.
Yes.
And they have to disrupt themselves in order to actually embrace fintech instead of doing these accelerators, hackathons, and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, totally agree. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I said.
And it's the tech giants that you believe will actually be the real disruptor to the banks, not the startups in that sense. Yeah. It's your Facebook, your Alipay, and, you know, these guys, the Facebook money in that world, right? What's stopping them from, you know, going 100% dedication into the banking sector. Yeah. That's what will disrupt. And then Karam, being the party pooper as always. On the 30th of December, decided to put another article to counter your argument and saying that, you know, fintech folks take a chill pill.
Yeah.
And Karam, why do you have to just
grin? I didn't bring the chill pill. I actually brought it by it myself because I was so stressed out, worried about being late for the show.
Why did you have to pop that fintech bubble last day of the year?
Correct. No, not so much that, but I think, like I said, Siva is so rational and grounded and just knowledgeable of the ecosystem as it goes, as they come, right? For him to have fallen into the abyss of this... this cauldron of hype, of over-exaggeration, just worried me.
Just to wrap up, so I've wrapped up Dr. V. Sivapalan's article. Just to wrap up on your counter-argument, you were saying that the hype around fintech is getting so hot that you will fear it will contribute to global warming.
Yeah, you can quote me on that, man. You can take that to the United Nations, okay?
And it's not, you're saying it's not going to replace banks and the financial institutions and so forth.
Absolutely.
And all. They're not going to be in that danger of being, you know, like that Kodak moment in that area. You don't believe that's going to happen?
No, you look at what's going on now. I mean, I think Siva shared an article with me yesterday about PayTim, which is, you know, the most successful fintech model in India right now, and the company in India right now. And
which belongs to Alibaba, by the way.
Yeah, Alibaba bought into them, right, at like $650 million, sometime like US dollars last year. You know, he shared with me that example, and I read the article, and they got a license to operate a digital bank. And if you read what the CEO says, he said we want to serve the unbanked, those who are not served by the banking system, and the ones who are already in the banking system, but they're not served properly. So he's looking at these two niches. He never said that I'm now going to, thank goodness I got my license, I'm going to disrupt, I'm going to take over the bank. So that the rhetoric now, my concern and my issue is with the rhetoric saying that they're going to, you know, take over bank. Not so much in the insurance space, but, you know, banks are going to be by the wayside. And for Siva then to give an example of Maybank, you know, in this article, they said that banks will not be around by 2025. I said, come on, lah. You know, somebody...
and that's why we brought Dr.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so, and he can defend it. But I said, it's not going to happen. I will do the bhangra in my kashera on top of the console if any bank in 2025 closes down...
You're going to be in trouble, man.
And, you know, and because of fintech. Because of fintech.
We have to get your thoughts into this. So this fintech bubble, and you like Karam has mentioned, you're in this space and you're now sort of very much interested into the fintech space, and you, that article kind of, for me, it made sense personally.
Oh, thank you.
But I feel Karam also has some sense into
a lot less
a lot less. But tell us a bit about, you know, your understanding of the fintech and why you believe so much so that, you know, it will actually be a disruptor for banks, and especially, you know, in 2025 banks will die in that sense.
Okay, so there are a few points I want to make here, right? The first one is about time. If you look at a lot of the discussion that's going on, people are only looking at what's happening today. Mm. They're looking at what's happening today or tomorrow, next month, you know, oh, are you going to adopt Bitcoin tomorrow or something like that? You know, Karam did say that, right? Oh, if you adopt Bitcoin to pay salaries, then I'll believe in fintech, right? I'm talking about a long-term perspective. I'm talking about, you know, another 9 years from now, 2025. Right? Now, if you look at technology and the pace of development of technology, it's unbelievable how technology is developing. 2 years ago, nobody was talking about fintech, right? 2 years later, it's everywhere. So many things are happening, right? I think the discussion has to look at what's going to happen in the future and not just about what's happening today. Because most of the discussion is centered around what's happening today, or it's not going to be disrupted, but you are really not looking into the future. Now, if you look at the pace of tech development, right, it's moving so quickly, it is totally unpredictable. We'll never know what's going to happen in about 5 years' time, what more 10 years' time, right? Now, if you look at, for example, Moore's Law, right? Moore's Law said the speed of processing by computers will double every 2 years. And I'm saying that the same thing is happening with technology, right? Whatever you predict will happen twice as fast. And that's why I'm saying by 2025, things are really going to be disrupted.
And currently, the fintech space is buzzing because there are a lot of startups. And I think that's why fintech, that word sort of came up, because fintech is just financial and technology being merged together. And it's been around, probably even the ATM, you can call it like a fintech thing as well, right?
No, but I think you should look at the terminology fintech as disruptive financial technology.
And startups are the ones sort of leading the charge for, you know, you would say the phase one of the fintech world, right? Yeah. Because these are the guys who are, you know, are nimble, they are agile, they're quick, they're flexible, and they're willing to take that risk.
Right.
Because banks are, you know, if not the most highly regulated industry ever, they can't take a risk.
Well, they're highly regulated, they don't take risks, they still think very, you know, very old-fashioned way. I still think that, you know, they're living in a different world. They don't think they're going to be disrupted, but they are going to be disrupted, you know.
No, but I do see banks being aware that they will be disrupted, right? Like Rajate Maimuna, when she was with Hong Leong Islamic, she's of course now with Arab Malaysian Bank. When she was on for the first What's Next in 2015, she did say that she is very concerned about fintech. In fact, she was more concerned about fintech impacting banks than Ganesh, who was sitting next to her. And I say, whoa, this is a very, you know, a deja vu or you know, like they're transposed, right? They each should be talking, taking the other's role. So she's very concerned. The fact that banks are aware, I'm saying, so you're leaving out the equation of the banks, right? Well-capitalized, well-funded companies, you know, staff, there are a lot of smart people there. They hire smart people. This argument that they're going to be disrupted seems to totally totally ignore that they have blinkers on, then they're just going to keep counting their money as it comes in every day, carry on with business as usual. It's not business as usual for them. They know what's going on.
Of course, banks know what's going on because, you know, we see so many banks doing, you know, hackathons and accelerator programs. But for you, Dr. Siva, you believe that that isn't the right way of them embracing fintech.
It's not just banks. Mm. Every large organization in the world, all right, can never develop the latest technology or cannot come up with the greatest innovations. All the best innovations come up from startups, right? And Karamjit made one point. He said, when bankers leave the banks and startup technology companies, you know, that's when it'll happen.
It serious,
I think that is totally wrong. That's the worst kind of thinking ever. Because every single
disruption... Can we edit that from the podcast, please?
All the disruptions that happen don't happen from people from the particular industry, right? If you look at, Patrick Groh, we talked about him, look at what he did with iProperty. He's not from the property sector. Mm. Mark Cheng is not from the employment sector. Yeah. He never did that. Even if you look at Goh Peng Ui, right, from Silver Lake Axis, he was not a banker either, but he built core banking systems and he's a billionaire doing that. So this kind of thinking that, the banks have the money, they have the talent, so, they'll not be disrupted, that's absolute rubbish. Yeah. They will be disrupted because of that fact. Because of that, they have the money, they think they're comfortable, they can beat everybody. Because they think they have the talent, they think they can overcome everything else. That's not going to happen. The disruption is going to come from outside the banking system. Mm. They are the disruptors.
So what can banks or financial institutions do? They're doing to a certain extent of what they can of, trying to embrace it to a certain, doing the hackathons and accelerator programs and trying to maybe,
Who are they kidding? What the hell are they going to gain from a hackathon or an accelerator program, right? So they're all falling into this belief that, if we work with a few small startups here and there, maybe we'll adopt some technology and we'll do something. That's absolute rubbish. That's not going to happen. That's why I said if the banks are going to survive, they have to become technology companies themselves. I think one of the points I made here is this. In the world today, anything that can be digitized will be digitized.
Correct, yeah.
And banking systems and banking services can be digitized. Yeah. Like P2B loans, for example, right? Peer-to-peer lending. It's digitizing the entire lending and borrowing process. You don't need anything physical anymore. You have a platform. You have the crowd that becomes a whole bunch of lenders. They lend money, and a bunch of the crowd that also borrows money.
We've seen it to a certain degree with equity crowdfunding.
Yeah.
And that's in some way like a P2P kind of system.
It's actually crowdfunding in a way, right? So whether it's loan crowdfunding, which is P2P, or equity crowdfunding, it's crowdfunding in a way. It's using a platform. It doesn't require anything physical, right? Mm. So, and that's actually digitizing the whole experience. No? And I think the other thing that we need to look at
By the way, I just let the audience, Siva brought an encyclopedia worth of notes. Huh?
It's just two pages, Karam.
Karam brought the whole internet.
The whole internet with you, okay? I don't have anything. I think we need to look at the evidence, right? So, I'm trained as a lawyer, so maybe I look at evidence, right? I did my PhD, I have to look at evidence, right? If you say you don't have the evidence, you don't have any statistics, you can't back anything up, right? Mm-hmm. So let's look at the evidence, right? Karam just not looking at the evidence. He's looking at this from a very...
Edit that out of the podcast also, please.
He's looking at it from a very emotional perspective.
No, I'm not.
The banks are well-funded.
I see
the emo
out there.
That's
not emotional.
He's talking to people and getting the gauge from the bankers who all think that, trust is a big thing.
I got to speak to both sides.
I can't like trust in a while.
What do you mean trust is rubbish?
You look at the evidence, okay? And I put some of this in my article already, right? If you look at the UK, right? Peer-to-peer lending to SMEs is now 13% of the banking system loans already. 13% of SMEs are borrowing on P2P platforms. Mm. And the growth of P2P is 200% compared to 2% for conventional banking. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you are looking at
that
and saying,
the base,
wow.
You're multi-billions,
$100
billion, 2% of $100 billion versus, 30% of £100 million or even £300 million is minuscule.
Sure.
Minuscule.
So let's talk numbers, okay? In China, it's already 90 billion, okay? Of
renminbi
loans,
or ringgit.
Of loans, 90 billion US dollars, by the way,
okay.
Of loans on P2P platforms.
Wow.
Okay? Now, Statista, the statistics portal, predicts in the US, in 2015, it's not a prediction, the actual was 64 billion US dollars on P2P. By 2025, they predict it will be $1 trillion U.S. dollars. Now, if people are borrowing or using platforms to borrow money, they're not taking money from the banks. Now, why do people go to banks? So this whole thing about trust, right? I think trust is highly overrated, right? Since when did you ever go to a bank and say, oh, bank, I trust you, that's why I'm coming and borrow money from you? It's actually the other way around. They lend you money because they think they trust you, right? You don't go to a bank. You only go to a bank because you have no choice today. Today, either you go to a bank or you go to a money lender along, right? The along can break your legs. The bank don't break your legs. Yeah. That's the only difference, really, right? You go to a bank because you got no choice. When you are given a choice, like P2P lending, equity crowdfunding, when you're given a choice, then you look at which is the better alternatives. Ultimately, when you borrow money, you're going to look at what? You're going to look at what's the interest rate. Whoever can give me the best interest rate. Even if you go to a bank today, there's no loyalty with banks. You go to the bank that can give you the best interest rate.
Sure, yeah.
You might be banking with Maybank, but you might go and borrow from CIMB because they give you the best rate.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, if you look at that, right? The only reason people borrow from banks today is because they have no choice. When given choices, they will go with the best choice. And if P2P is the best choice, that's what they're going to do.
Sure, they will. But I'm saying that banks will evolve and adapt, and they'll start offering some of these services too. So you're talking about all these, like, the banks will not be able to offer the same services. They will be able to. And who will, and you know, it's up to the consumer to choose. So
that's
totally ignoring the role the banks can play to adapt. So
That's where I say
that's the big flaw in your
There's no flaw.
Oh no, why me? There's no flaw.
There is no flaw. Okay, I said in my article the only way the banks can survive, okay, is via creative destruction and becoming technology companies themselves. And that's what you're saying now. What you're saying is they have to offer the same services, right?
Or maybe even better, but they will adapt and offer, yes.
Well, they will adapt? I don't think so. I think some might adapt. I think a lot won't. Banks are ultra-conservative. The thinking, it's all about thought processes, right? People that have been working in banks for years and years and years, they've built up this whole entire conservative thought process and all that. To do creative destruction, which means to destroy your way of doing business for a better way of doing business, is going to be the toughest thing in the world.
No, but
that's why most of the banks will not do it.
No,
they will
They will, because as you see your revenue, yearly revenue, you know, coming down, and you're going to analyze why is our revenue down? Is our competitors' revenue down? And who are these? What is this P2P? What's going on there? Why are people going to them? They will adapt because they will see it, right? Year on year, nothing is invisible. People will know the reasons why. It's impossible for any bank to just keep its head in the sand and say, oh, no, this is just a blip and we'll recover after 2 years or 3 years.
I'm going to throw in one more curveball to this argument here. I'm going to put in an example of telco, the telco space. Yeah. Because I think, Karim, you mentioned in your article in the back in the dot-com era.
Yeah, in the year 2000,
telco was, you know, was one of those companies who saying, oh, they're going to be disrupted and everything. They came out and they're now in Bangladesh, for example. You know, Telenor is doing banking, doing fintech using your mobile phones because they are a networking player and they realize there is a segment that we can play, which is that, you know, peer to peer lending of, you know, borrowing money, just completely excluding all the banks aside. Will telco players as well have a say in this,
or
come back in this fintech space and actually be then a player in bank instead of? Maybe it's not the tech companies. Maybe it's not the Facebook and the Alipay or, you know, to come in and disrupt the banks. Maybe it's the telco players because they are the networkers, you know. They are the ones who have the data, because you come back to banking is all about that trust and the networks and they...
he said trust is overrated.
Sorry, trust is overrated. So Karim is...
I disagree.
So Karim is saying is like, you know, because they have their data of the people.
Yeah.
Telco players have the same as well. True. What's stopping telco players in going into, like, let's just...
I think it can happen when, because like you said, both Telenor and Axiata, because I've met both the CEOs, right, group CEOs, and they say that they're evolving to become more digital organizations. And when you become more digital, all this, everything is on the cards. They're not going to not go into any segment, right? They will. And if you get a license, you forget that the regulatory will still play a role. And when regulations comes in, then everyone plays by the same role, has to play by the same rules.
Because the banking sector, again, is very highly regulated.
Yes. And there's a reason for that.
They can't take any risk. But for the telco players and the tech players, for them, it's a very different industry because they are not highly regulated.
No, not yet. But if they start moving into money or deposit taking, if they're not going to do deposit taking, then maybe okay. If they're going to play around the fringes so they don't get into the rule box, maybe. But if they start, you know, offering more banking services, they will come under the ambit of banking regulations. You cannot avoid that.
But policies and stuff will change when you see...
Exactly.
You know,
policy will adapt.
And that's one of the points I make in that whole Facebook discussion that was there. The only ones that can save the bank, in my opinion, are actually the regulators. If the regulator decide to protect the banks, maybe because they want to protect jobs or whatever it is, then, you know, the banks can still survive. But if the regulators decide to look after the interests of the people, if they decide to look after the interests of business, the economy, and companies, and
but
say
the
we,
banks
have,
are
and
playing
we have
that
to
role
hang
now.
On, Karam, and if they say we have to open this up because it's in the interest of SMEs to be able to get more loans, so because they can provide more employment than banks, if they decide to do that and open up the space, that's where banks will really start losing out because now they are protected, right? If even like P2P lending, for example, right? SC has only licensed 6 companies. In China, they didn't license anyone. Anyone could do that.
Mm.
But China does business in a very different way. The regulators in China allow you to go out there and innovate and do whatever you want, and then they will start regulating. In Malaysia and many other countries, that's not the way. Regulations come in first, right? But even now, you look at it, you look at Malaysia, you look at India, you look at everywhere else, regulators are opening up because they know that you can't hold back technology. Right? Change is coming. Innovation is happening. So even in India, they're opening up the space. They're letting technology companies come in and offer some form of banking services, whether it's payments or whatever. In Malaysia, we're doing that as well.
Right.
So the protection for banks is getting less and less and less. And somewhere down the line, it will be open. Anybody probably can come and do this within certain
there will
restrictions.
Be regulations
maybe. Some restrictions, but they will allow a lot of other players to come in. It's not just going to be only banks can lend money. That's not going to happen anymore, right? Mm. Now, when that happens, again, banks are going to be disrupted, whether it's the telcos or anybody else, right? Sure, the telcos can do this as well. But if you look at the database that telcos have, they have very little information about the database, actually. How much do they know about me? They don't know much about me. How much does Facebook know about me? How much does Facebook know about Karam? They know about this entire discussion that we're having as well.
It all started from a Facebook post.
Exactly, right? So, you know, Facebook, Alibaba, right? Alibaba knows so much about all the companies that are buying stuff and products on them. Amazon knows so much about us as well. They are the ones that have so much of data. They have quality data. Mm. Telcos may have data, but telcos don't have quality data.
It's creepy to know that, you know, because of, you know, services like Alibaba and so forth, who, you know, people in China may, you know, buy their whole entire house furniture using Alibaba itself. You know, Alibaba will exactly know what kind of house you're living in, what you've been spending. I could offer you a loan for your next house and all that kind of stuff.
What about Google, right? Google knows everything about you. They know whether you're going on a holiday. Mm. You know, I went to New Zealand, so I searched New Zealand. Now I see New Zealand advertisements on my Google all the time. Yeah. So Google knows so much about you because today, everything that we want to do, we go to Google first. You want to look for a bank loan.
Bing. You got to use Bing.
You want to look for a bank loan, you go to Google and say, oh, which is the one, the lowest interest rate, blah, blah, blah. What if Google starts offering these kind of services? And they can. There's nothing to stop them. Right?
So the
role of regulation is important, right? It will always be there. And when fintechs have to play within the rules, then it's going to be a different game.
Yeah.
I don't think regulators are protecting banks. And when you say they're protecting banks, sounds like there's a conspiracy. There's a reason this whole system has evolved for over hundreds of years. There's a reason it's in place. Yeah, there are, everybody works within rules, right? So you have the regulation there, and the regulation hasn't hurt the economy, right? You've got loans being made and all that. And when bad banks do bad things, they get punished. Although in the U.S., bad banks didn't with the 2000.
I do a Trump on your car. No,
the 2008 they didn't. I'm saying yes.
No,
I know. I agree with you.
But if you look at it, right?
2008 in the U.S., the banks that did all those I forgot the term they use, right? Toxic loans were housing loans were repackaged into derivatives and all that. Yeah,
but
I know.
Were the banks punished?
No, there in the US they weren't. But generally there are rules and things have been chugging along within the rules. And fintechs will come in and play within the rules. And banks are a player also. So, and you know, when you say why should regulators want to protect banks? Well, maybe because they employ hundreds and thousands of people in just Southeast Asia, right? Pay billions
there
in revenue.
There are jobs involved.
They pay billions.
You know?
No, exactly. They pay billions in taxes. So that's a good thing. Where you why aren't you saying? Why isn't that a bad thing? They're not protecting them, but they're within the regulation. These entities are doing this, right? They're playing a role. They're, you know, paying salaries. They're paying taxes versus the fintechs who are all, you know, a handful right now. Some of them may succeed. So I'm not saying that. I'm saying the hype about them being able to succeed is just overblown. So I'm not against fintech. I'm saying just keep it down at the base level, right? The reality of there's a huge amount of work ahead of them before they gain any traction. You look at what Robin Lee from his startup
Hello Goal.
Yeah, even he said, look at what he shared on the discussion also, right, about the challenges that he faces, right? The mindset out there in the traditional world, it's still very engraved around, you know, can you do this around the existing banks, you know, because they are trusted, they are within regulatory framework. It's going to be very hard. I'm saying with this hype cycle, these fintechs end up getting a sense of entitlement. Like, you know, like this banker that I met said, you know, he gets emails from guys saying, I'm in fintech, you know, can we meet up? And, you know, a bank Negara and SC is behind me and supporting us. He said, bugger off, man. Maybe it's a stronger word, lah, you know, cat. But then, you know, just because of that, I think I want to engage with you. So It's very difficult. You got to play with the existing players, which is why Paytm is doing that, right? They said they're going to partner with banks. Why didn't the guy say, we're going to now go out and kill the banks or disrupt them?
Because at the moment, he cannot do that. The regulations require him to still partner with the banks, right? But that's today. What's going to happen 10 years from now? That's what you got to be looking at. Okay. And that's why, you know, this whole thing about the hype cycle and all that, there's nothing wrong with hype. Hype is actually good because it brings more people into the ecosystem.
But when they bring them in for the wrong reason, they may think it's easier or whatever. I think that the journey is going to be so hard,
sure,
right?
Even guys,
with the hype, come in with your eyes open.
I've interviewed Dr. John Cohn, who's like an IBM fellow in the US. He's a mad scientist person, been on TV, you know, very famous guy. And I once asked him, like, you know, is the tech world just, you know, things that people just hype about? And he said it's like everything in the tech world, you have to hype it up because that is when it will start driving
innovation. I'm in good company then.
But
that's
the beauty of you know, the start of 2017. We're talking about, you know, fintech, is it overhyped, is this going to change? We will know this year around, because, you know, a lot of people are talking about fintech. So let's see, you know, which sort of comes to truth. And I think at the end of the 2017, we'll probably have you both on again, Karam, and probably Dr. Siva too. Let's look at, you know, what happened in 2017.
Can.
Are we still on the pathway?
I mean, can we please have a extra large, you know, a 2 kg humble pie sitting in front of Dr. Siva? Because I make the prediction during the show, he'll be eating that throughout the show.
We will go for a short break while Karam has his pie in just a moment. BFM 89.9.
Before Friday materializes, BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, this is Tech Thursday, and wow, we needed a breather for that, because
I could have gone on, man. Siva was on thin ice already. That break came in time to save him there, man.
We actually prepared a lot more stories besides just the debate, but we have to just throw all of them out except for one, because you just recently, Karam, you just recently published your story on old style BPO and business, which is business processing outsourcing, is dead and irrelevant, according to your chat with Accenture.
Yeah, correct. I met with Manish Sharma in November, actually, right? And he's the group operating officer, Accenture Operations. So he's running in all the entire Accenture's 50, you know, network operating centers, you know, around the world. I think over 100,000 headcount. So he says that, look, in the old days, they used to think Accenture, they did think BPO was about labor arbitrage, right? And it's about, you know, humans performing tasks that fall under this category of the task is repeatable, it's measurable, and it's transaction-based, you know. And he says, but today Accenture relies on robots. They call them robotic process automation, or robots, R-O-B-O-S. And such has been the success of this that you don't need so many people anymore. So, and that's why Manish says that, you know, the old style of BPO is dead and irrelevant. And, you know, Accenture's own definition now, how they define BPO, is that it's about artificial intelligence driving insights, which is important, and business outcomes managed by engines, okay? And cloud and platforms, with super intelligent people managing the role of robots rather than managing the job or that the robots are running themselves. And he says it's all about the quality of the people you have. And when I interviewed, I did a story on GE when they opened up a diagnostic and remote monitoring center in KL in December. Also, the guy said the same thing. They only have 8 people managing the center, and he pointed to his forehead. You know, he said it's what's up here that's important. And here you have money saying the same thing again. You just need intelligent people, and the beauty of it is you think you need people with technical skills or engineering skills, right? No, not at all. Can you imagine Accenture has already automated almost 20,000 roles? That means jobs, right? And yet nobody who was managing those jobs have lost their jobs. They've just been able to reskill those people. And he says that when, and this is important, they were able to reskill their people. He says that when Accenture hires, and this point that he made got some traction on my LinkedIn conversation, said they don't look for any specific technical capability or skill set. Instead, they rely on their own internally developed aptitude tests that looks for, what he says is the biggest skill Accenture requires, intellectual curiosity. That and the ability to learn new skills are the most important to us, you know. We don't want people who are stuck in a job, in a box defined by the job scope, right? He wants people who can adapt, learn quickly, change themselves every few years. That's amazing. So they hire across skill sets. And coincidentally, Christmas night, I was having dinner with a friend whose sister is American, and she was working as a surgeon in New York, right? Brain surgery. So whether she's the main surgeon, but she's the operating theater when brain surgery is done, she's now like 50 years old. So she got tired of doing that as a career. Can you imagine that? She's now working one of the top 5 technology companies in the world in their blockchain, group. Just because she expressed an interest in blockchain, she think it can make a difference to healthcare. So they say, we obviously know you've got the brain power. Come and join us. You'll be in this team and work your magic or do what you think. Can you imagine? Because obviously she has got the ability to relearn and adopt and adapt new skills. That's such an important skill to have for parents out there who are driving the kids to be engineers or doctors or lawyers or accountants, right? I think you need EQ and IQ together. Please make sure your kids have a combination of that.
And before we leave, Dr. Siva, I just want to check on 2017, then your thoughts of, you know, since you're the president of the Malaysian Business Angel Network. What's your sort of like, you know, thing to look forward to 2017? Karam's obviously saying, you know, AI and all this is going to come in and help instead of, you know, eliminate jobs, which is always supposed to worry. Now, for your side of you, what do you see in 2017?
I think for Malaysia, that's a bit too soon. Mm. That'll probably happen maybe in 3 years' time. Right?
1,000 days, okay.
Yeah. You know, I think that's going to happen. It's going to happen, right? I mean, I look at technology and I see the changes that it's bringing to almost every single industry, right? Today, we're talking about fintech, right? We talked about telco earlier. We talked about media earlier. Everything is changing. I think the one thing we have to accept is technology is going to change everything, whichever industry you're in, whether you're in manufacturing, whether you're in BPO. We're talking about BPO, right? People actually, in the end, people are no longer needed in BPO. Right? 5 years ago, it was all about people. You just want to fill people, fill up seats, right? Today, you got 8 people managing a BPO center, right? So technology is changing everything. So if I want to get one message across, right, to the Malaysian audience and to business people,
there's
and
only 8 people listening to the show right now. My intelligence
right?
tells me.
You know, it would be that, you know, you better be very careful about what technology is going to do to your industry or your business. Because it's going to disrupt everything. It might not happen this year, but it will happen within the next few years. This year is going to be fintech. Last year was half of it was fintech. This year is fintech. Who knows? Next year might be manufacturing. Very soon, manufacturing plants will might need 10 people to do everything. Right?
They already are. Very highly automated plants.
So I think technology is going to change everything. We have to be prepared for it.
All right. That's all the time we have. You obviously just have to go on to
digitalreadinglist.com. Reading list, yeah, man.
There's a whole bunch of things that you can read up. You can especially read up.
We're going to start with Dr. Siva's article.
Gotta start with that.
We'll be dead in 2025.
And then you read Karam's party pooper article on fintech.
Reality. My dose of reality.
Anyways, it's been a pleasure. Dr. Siva, thank you very much for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
And obviously, Karam Jasingh from Digital News Asia.
You can join me in saying Chakaday.
Chakaday.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.